Love, Lust, and Laughter with Dr. Diana Wiley and Billy Sage, Fridays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Aloha and welcome to Wiley and Sage, Love, Lust, and Laughter. This is your sidekick, Bill Sage, with our host, Dr. Diana Wiley, and today, special guest, Jack Morin, Ph.D., who is a fellow who talks about peak erotic experiences, among other things, and who better to peek out on erotic experiences than the woman who sees all, knows all, dare I say, does all, well, with a grain of chocolate, perhaps, like a diaper or something. Anyway, here she is, our scintillating hostess with the mostest, Dr. Diana Wiley.
Thank you, Billy, and how good it is to have you back. Bill's been on a leave of absence. His precious wife, Jan, died just 2 months ago now.
2 months ago yesterday, yeah.
Yes, from cancer. So you've been in our thoughts and prayers, Bill, and I know this is a hard time, and you're moving forward, and you've got lots of support, and you can even provide us, I think, still with some laughter, the third part of the title of this show.
Oh, yes, she was the one that said, no matter what happens, always remember to take care of yourself. And she said, never lose your sense of silliness. And throughout it all, she was even smiling up to 17 hours before her life ended. So,
see, wow. I feel privileged to have met Jan. And
we also speak English. Very good, too.
I know. I'm thinking, I'm sort of getting emotional about it and stumbling over my words. But yeah, the silliness is so important, and we're going to get to you, Jack, in just a second. The original silly comes from Old English, salag, and originally it meant four things: to be happy, healthy, prosperous, and blessed. And I think you embody the original form of silliness, the original definition.
Well,
and anyway, Bill, I'm really glad to have you back. And Jack Morin, Dr. Jack, hello.
Hello there, Diana.
And,
hi, Bill. Hello. Aloha, Jack. Good to meet
yes.
you.
Yes. And Jack is somebody that I've known for quite a few years now. And I got to see him again at a conference in San Francisco, the Quad S conference, just about a month ago. And so I'm thrilled that Jack's on the program today and will be again on the program in 2 weeks because there's a lot to cover. And Billy, I'm wondering if you could kind of give a somewhat formal introduction of Dr. Jack Morin.
A somewhat formal introduction. Well, he is a gentleman who grew up in a middle-class neighborhood in Detroit, the proud Motor City and the future home Motown Records. He was a good boy, self-described, a mixed blessing to be sure. On the plus side, he earned a tremendous amount of freedom in early age, but later on took a lot of work to get out from under the impossible expectations of being a good boy. So he got into radio in high school and in college at Wayne State. He had a dual major in mass communications and psychology, worked as a DJ, and then he became an activist against the Vietnam War and for civil rights. And he went in Chicago in 72. He headed out in a VW Beetle, drove out to San Francisco, and suddenly found himself into adventures in sex therapy thanks to people like Masters and Johnson influencing his state of mind. And the next thing you know, he's a gentleman who starts entering a doctoral program in clinical psychology at Saybrook University, fairly new school at the time, founded by humanistic scholars with a willingness to allow students to design their own courses of study. He got into sexology and sex therapy, something which almost every mammal with a pulse and opposable thumbs has a deep interest in, especially those of the Homo sapien variety. And he chose to do a dissertation on the anal awareness process that had developed with a focus on how to test effectiveness in any therapeutic endeavor. That was graduating back in 1978. By 1981, he became a researcher with the popular book Anal Pleasure and Health, A Guide for Men, Women, and Couples, which has been in print ever since. Now, I don't say that to be anal retentive, actually perhaps more expansive than anything else. So with that introduction, the future is his and ours, and it's always now, so that's about as now as I can get up to now.
Thank you. And if any of our listeners want to read even more about Dr. Jack, please go to www.jackmorin.com. And we're going to be talking today about his book, The Erotic Mind, which was first published in 1995. I used it in part for my PhD studies. And I can remember reading it about in 1998, and it's been fun to look at it again. And Jack, you had told me that you're really seriously thinking about doing a new edition of this book.
Yeah, I really would like to do that a lot, Diana, because for a number of reasons, I've learned a lot, actually,
yes,
since I first wrote that book. And then the other thing that's happened that's really quite exciting to me is it's partly based on a survey of peak erotic experiences, which I know we're going to be talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when I did the original research on this survey that asks people about the two very most exciting and memorable real-life experiences of their entire lives, and then also ask them about their number one sexually exciting fantasy of all time and
yes,
their thoughts about what makes it so exciting. And then I analyzed the content of these stories, which was very enlightening, to say the least. But when I first was doing that research, I was analyzing about 1,000 peak experiences, which was quite a lot at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But in the years since, people have been filling out my sexual excitement survey, which
mm-hmm.
is what it's called, because it's all over the internet and
mm-hmm.
has been for many years now. And now I have way over 7,000 people who have responded, and each, so there's three stories each. I now have whatever it is, 20-some thousand peak experiences to analyze instead of 1,000. So a lot more data to work with. Pretty exciting.
It's very exciting, and I think a new edition is really going to be important. Imagine having that many respondents. Of course, now with the internet, this sort of thing is possible.
Yeah, it opens the whole world up in a way.
It sure does. And I suspect that people answering your SES, sexual excitement survey, is that correct?
That's it, yeah.
I think that it could be very therapeutic in a way to sort of look at their own eroticism. In the beginning of your book, which people can still get by going to Amazon.com, The Erotic Mind, Jack Morin, M-O-R-I-N, I'd like you to give all of us a definition. What is eroticism? You asked that on page 2 of your book.
Yeah. Well, I tend to make a distinction between the definition of sex and the definition of eroticism, although there's lots of room for different ideas on that. But to me, sex, for one thing, is the word we use for gender, male or female. It also refers to a set of activities with a sexual charge to them, as in having sex. But eroticism is really where our capacities to be sexual, that is to have arousal and to have orgasm, where these abilities that we're born with intersect with all other aspects of our lives. And so eroticism is how arousal, orgasm, and living all come together and mix it up together, and out of that we each develop our own really totally unique way of expressing our sexuality in the world and in our own minds.
That's a very good description, and you quoted a sexologist, David Snarch, and we, of course, admire his work so much.
Yeah.
He defines eroticism as the pursuit and delight in sexual pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of a nice add-on to what you just said.
Yeah, certainly very compatible.
If only Thomas Jefferson had been dyslexic during the Declaration of Independence, the happiness of pursuit.
the happiness of pursuit. That's
well, ask
good.
Sally Hemings, as a matter of fact.
Did you just make that up now, Bill?
I cannot tell a lie. I had a cherry tree nearby. I'll quit while I'm behind. Speaking of behind, the topic today is...
Yeah, I think... Dr. Morin's book, Anal Pleasure and Health, is something we will discuss in part 2. We probably won't get to that today. Anyway, you have in your first chapter, Sex and Self-Discovery. I wanted you to expand and ask you a little bit more about where you say that anything that inhibits arousal, including anxiety and or guilt, can under different circumstances amplify it. Now, this was a very original idea you came up with, because most people don't even think about that. Can you expand on that, Jack?
Yeah, well, this is really one of the things that makes our erotic lives so multi-layered and complex and totally fascinating, is because the word I use really is eroticism is paradoxical. And by that I mean things can often have the opposite effect that we might think they're going to have. You mentioned anxiety, which is a great example. Let's take that.
Yeah.
Most of us think of, if we're too anxious, it's going to inhibit us sexually speaking, and there's no doubt that that is true. Too much anxiety is not good for positive, pleasurable sex. It tends to shut us down. But if there's just a certain hint, let's say, of anxiety that comes along with the feeling like, boy, we're really breaking the rules now, or what if we get caught, or what if someone in the next room overhears us, or someone sees us, or we're in a semi-public place, we're making out in a car or wherever it may be, and a little hint of anxiety actually comes in, and instead of inhibiting us, it adds an extra charge.
A little frisson, as it were.
That's right. An extra energy, an emotional energy to the experience, so that what might inhibit us under the right conditions flips around and gives us a burst of excitement. And we do this all the time, and guilt, which is the other emotion you mentioned, these are very paradoxical emotions in our sexual lives. Guilt also is a big time inhibitor. That's its purpose, to stop us from doing certain things. But, so if we have a lot of guilt, we're going to probably be inhibited by it. But sometimes having just a little guilt, like we're being so wonderfully bad, or naughty or sleazy or even disgusting for some people, and the feeling that goes along with that, like I'm really not supposed to be doing this, or what would mother think, adds again an extra charge instead of inhibiting us. It can go either way.
And you even mentioned Catholicism in your book. I don't recall exactly where. I have noted over the almost 30 years I've been doing this work that a number of my Catholic clients, even if they're now lapsed Catholics, often have some residual repressed guilt, that if that does actually not work for them in their sexuality.
Well, it can be mixed. You know, one of the things I found, speaking of the Catholic folks who answered my survey, you know, one of the themes that really stood out in a lot of the erotic stories was this theme of breaking the rules, of being bad, naughty, and a little sense of maybe anxiety and guilt that could go along with doing that.
For example, going into confession booth and saying, "Bless me, Father, for I'm about to sin."
Yes, something like that. That those themes actually showed up in the general sample in just over one-third of all the erotic stories had that theme of being bad woven into the story. But
the naughtiness factor.
The naughtiness factor, I call it.
Yeah.
Among those, however, raised as Catholics, regardless of what their beliefs are now, that doesn't seem to matter. But it's about what was going on when they were first developing their sexual lives as children and adolescents. And those raised in a Catholic environment where there's a lot of overt, it's not hidden, very overt prohibitions, is that those folks learn, or some of them, not only that the prohibitions can be a big-time inhibitor like we were discussing, but they can also charge up sex, and that they become an aphrodisiac. Breaking the rules becomes a point of excitement, so that among those raised as Catholics, two-thirds, double their stories, contain these themes of being bad, naughty, and breaking the rules.
These are stories and all fantasies or actual experiences?
In both. Okay. The real-life experiences and in fantasies. So the idea here, and I think this is a very important thing for anyone who wants to develop a better understanding of their own eroticism and their own turn-ons, to kind of raise the question with yourself, what was going on in my life during my childhood and my adolescence, during my development as a person, that has woven its way into what turns me on. And I think that we all do that because, like I say, eroticism is where our sexuality interacts with the life process. And so our experience is inevitably woven into our turn-ons, and it's a deep expression of who we are and where we're coming from and what we want. It's all of that.
Your book is so well organized, and just to look at the table of contents is something else. You write toward the end of your first chapter what this book can do for you. The erotic mind is an invitation to a deeper understanding and appreciation of the role of eroticism in your life. This book is divided into three parts. So I think today we're mostly going to be discussing part one, the realms of passion, focusing primarily on erotic peak experiences. And then I think next week we'll focus more on part two. We'll see how it goes today, but part two is troublesome turn-ons, and part three, positively erotic. It's just a great book, Jack. I was so glad to have the opportunity to look at it again. I pulled it out of my library, and, you know, reading it now, almost 15 years later, my own development, thank goodness, has occurred, and my own life experiences and my sexuality and my eroticism. So I'm looking at it with eyes afresh and with a deeper...
It doesn't really stop, does it, that our development
right.
as erotic people,
yes.
As long as we remain interested in that and we are alive and breathing, it's part of us.
Essentially, having a pulse is the only requirement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I may interject briefly, when you said that about, I suddenly had totally forgotten, but in terms of the frisson of being slightly naughty, in 1993, I was found myself divorced, single, and unattached, and there was a lady that had expressed a little bit of interest in me. I didn't know how much, and we'd never done anything so much except go out for a movie. One night, we went to a show in Waikiki, and afterwards, it was a full moon, but a sort of a humid night, dead calm, and it was the roof of that area by the Royal Hawaiian Shopping Center. Somehow we took the wrong... We were walking on top of the roof. And she suddenly turned to me and said, make love to me, here, now. I said, on the roof in Waikiki of a public building? And she said, yes, now. And I went... My first thought was, uh-oh. And then my next thought was, aha. And aha overcame the uh-oh. The next thing I know, she was rather, shall we say, receptive. And the full moon is shining down. It was one of the most incredible experiences of my life, except around the corner comes a security guard sort of looking at us, and he suddenly turns his eyes, and all I could think of to say was, hello. And so he's sort of hiding behind, you guys, I know it's kind of a private, but kind of public, too. Maybe you can finish somewhere else. It was moonlit night.
Well, at least he was polite about it.
Yeah, so, he was. It seemed like he was sort of smiling and embarrassed. It didn't look like a violent crime was being committed. More like this moonlight madness. But yeah, I see what you mean. There's just that sometimes somewhere that frisson of just takes over everything else. So.
And don't you think, Bill, that experience could conceivably have gone another way? Because it did kind of make you, it sounds like, I know it would make me a little feel like on the spot, or maybe a feeling of pressure, oh my God, you know, I have to perform now.
I didn't even know she liked me.
Yeah, and you didn't see this coming, so to speak. And so it could have just made you anxious and uncomfortable. And it did.
There was a definite degree of anxiety.
That was there, yeah. And then it transformed, though, into a big turn-on.
Uh-huh, this is true. Now, I suppose it could have gone the other way.
It could have gone the other way.
Oh, yeah, but it's just that the situation, that there's a look for the moon, okay, how often is this?
The moon, I think, is what made the difference, really.
I mean, it was just, the moon is directly overhead, and it was just totally, this will probably be a once-in-your-lifetime experience now.
Yeah, you better go for it.
Well, it's a perfect, your story, Bill, is a perfect segue into discussing Jack's first chapter, Peak Erotic Experiences. unforgettable turn-ons or windows into your erotic mind. And I really like, Jack, the way you open up the chapter by noting and being grateful to Abraham Maslow. And he, of course, broke new ground by studying people he called self-actualizers. And say a little more, if you will, about how you tie the self-actualizing actualizers and some of the parallels and moments of ecstasy that might be more present for self-actualizers.
Yeah, well, I think that one of the points that Maslow made that I think is coming around a lot more these days in the studies in the field of positive psychology or the psychology of happiness is that, many of our potentials as human beings show up for us first at those peak moments. There's something that happens. There's certain moments where we become totally engaged in what we're doing. We lose our self-consciousness. We're not watching ourselves. We're not evaluating ourselves. We're really lost in the experience of the moment. We are fully 100% present. And at those times, not only do people report, generally, they're most satisfied and happy, but it's also a time when we get a flavor of what things might be like, because we tend to get a sense of our expansive selves, you know, of our potential, what we can be if we get out from under the things that normally hold us back. And that's why I recommend to people on a regular basis in my practice, in my therapy work, that people pay attention to their peak experience in life in general and in sexuality in particular, because it's an opportunity to raise the question, what was going on during that peak experience that made it so good? And what does that reveal about my own potential as a human being and as a sexual being? And people feel like many of these peak experiences are unforgettable because they can also be transformative. They can leave a lasting impact.
So that you have a sense of your larger, better self.
Right. It's something that you could then becomes potentially a guide to what we can be.
And you report, and I remember reading this as well, that Dr. Abraham Maslow noted a curious phenomenon, and it really has to do with pleasurable distortions of time and space in these peak experiences, where you are, to call on another Hungarian psychologist with a very difficult last name, being in flow, being exceptionally creative and not having a sense of the time. And you remember, can you pronounce his name?
No, I've never been able to pronounce his name. It starts with a C.
And it's Sergio Massey or something.
There's
there's
no vowels in it.
Yeah.
Or something.
Do you know Bill?
Well, spell it for me.
Oh, no, I couldn't even pull that up now, but he's a Hungarian.
But the book is called Flow. It's a very famous book, and it's a very good book. It's an important book because they really looked into when are people really satisfied and happy, and they developed a system where they would randomly send someone a signal to stop and notice what they're doing and actually jot it down and how they're feeling. And when people were absorbed in something challenging and fully engaged and losing track of time and stuff like that, and they felt challenged, but they felt up to the challenge, that those were reported as the most satisfying of all times that people have. And that could be, we don't have to be working. It could be play when we're totally absorbed in playing, or it could be in quiet, in meditation, or it could be in love. With someone, sharing a moment and totally lost in the moment. Nothing else is on our mind. These are the peak experiences that most of us would like to have more of because, in many ways, modern life has us so distracted that how often are we really fully present like that?
Not often enough.
Not enough.
And how often do you say to clients, I certainly say to clients, slow down, pay attention.
I say that to myself quite a lot,
yes,
actually.
Right. And do the sensate focus, and particularly for women who are pre-orgasmic, they're often so busy multitasking, mm-hmm. and not staying with the journey, the erotic journey. They're thinking, oh, well, maybe I'll get there, maybe I won't, but meantime they're thinking about other things, and it does not, it's not helpful to the whole sensual sexual experience.
Mm-hmm. And people are notoriously not particularly goal-oriented when they're having a peak experience. It's like everything is great at this moment for itself. We're not struggling to get to another moment,
mm-hmm.
or to finish it, or to wrap up this project, you know, or to prove anything. Those are all other things that I notice, you know, how many articles there are about sex in the popular magazines and particularly
yes.
women's magazines, but it's a lot of it is so goal-oriented, like, you know, how to blow your man's mind, you know, or
exactly.
Give him sex he'll never forget, or,
mm-hmm.
You know, the 10 secrets of this or that, and it's all about, like, producing an experience instead of being in an experience, it seems to me.
That's a very good point, Jack. I like that, and I hope our listeners are paying attention. Billy, maybe you give the number if anybody
yes,
wants
indeed.
To contribute to the conversation or ask Dr. Jack a question.
If you have a question, our studio line toll-free is 1-888-874-4888. Once again, that's 1-888-874-4888. Operators are standing by now.
We've missed you, Bill.
What you got on your mind? What's on the road ahead? Operators are standing by me. I see what I mean.
So we're going to go to a break in just a moment, and I'd like to talk about Dr. Jack's Chapter 2, The Erotic Equation. This is in his book, The Erotic Mind, which is a very well-written, as I said before, well-organized book, and it's readable, but it's got plenty of kind of deep messages and things that you may want to take some time to ponder. Have you had that feedback, Jack?
Oh, often. People
mm-hmm.
often say, you know, gee, I almost made it through one chapter, but I had to stop and think, you know.
Yes.
How does this apply to me? And I like that. It's not a book to be rushed through. It really is a guide to exploration, and that's takes time.
Yes, yes, it does. It does take time. So when I hear the little bit of music playing, even though it's a little bit before half past the hour, but maybe we'll go to the break a little early and come back a little early. And when we come back, we're going to talk about this erotic equation, which leads so well to the next chapter, which is the four cornerstones of eroticism. This is really important information, and it's high level, you know. This is for evolved people or people that want to become more sexually evolved. So please stay with us, and we will be back in just a few moments.
Come to the Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello. Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
Driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Progressive Radio Network. This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers.
And we are back with Wiley and Sage, Love, Lust, Laughter. The second half of the show, it's like the first half, only second. But that doesn't mean it's last in your mind. It's first and now, because it's always now. So there, or here, wherever here happens to be, you can reach us at 1-888-874-4888. And now here's the hostess who once was described as so sexy, she thought she might have a problem. Because what happened, she went to the doctor and said, I don't know, doctor, I don't feel sexy all the time, but a lot of people say I am sexy all the time. The doctor said, well, perhaps it's all in your mind, and you might be a carrier.
Well, where do you come up with this? That's funny.
Bad brains, bad brains. That's it, darling. You're contagious. You're a carrier.
Thank you, Bill.
You're very welcome.
So I think we're having a very progressive discussion on Progressive Radio Network, and it's been fun so far. I hope you're having a good time, too, Dr. Jack.
Oh, I am.
Good. So we're getting into the erotic equation from your book, The Erotic Mind, still available on Amazon.com. And it's Jack Morin. Am I pronouncing your last name right?
Oh, perfectly.
Perfectly, good. Yeah. M-O-R-I-N. So you're the erotic equation that you talk about, which I think is very original, and I know it came out of your SES survey, a sexual excitement survey, that attraction plus obstacles equal excitement. Now, can you talk more about this? Because a lot of people say, what? Obstacles?
Yeah,
what's that about?
You have to think twice about this thing. Well, remember how we were speaking earlier in the show about these paradoxical emotions like guilt and anxiety, where they can be inhibiting, but they can also be enhancing. Could go one way or another, which is a way of saying or exploring how the erotic experience is very dynamic and changeable.
Like the horny male Black Widow spider who thinks, God, she's sexy, but she looks like she could bite my head off.
Yeah, something just exactly like that.
Yes.
So the erotic equation basically says it starts with attraction, that what makes us, most of us, erotically interested is being drawn to someone or in some cases something that is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
To us, and usually for most of us, that means the person, if it's a person, is fascinatingly different than we are in some certain ways, but also similar enough that we can relate. So some mix of similarity and difference. But then there's also the magical aspect of attraction that we'll never be able to explain, and we'll use words like chemistry. Because we can't explain really why we're drawn to one person versus another. Some we can explain certain things about it, but there's an element that remains mysterious. But we start with the draw, the pull toward another fascinating person. And then that could lead us into a very satisfying sexual erotic exchange with that person that could be very nice and fulfilling. But what I found in asking people about their peak experiences is there seems to be another element that comes into play that works with attraction to intensify it, and that is what I call the obstacles. So that the equation goes, we start with attraction, then we have some kind of an obstacle that stands between us and the object of our desire that makes it maybe difficult to get to the one we desire. And a good obvious example of that would be in a long-distance relationship, or if we set our sights on an unavailable partner. It's very difficult then to gain access to that partner, and so the distance or the unavailability becomes the obstacle, but it makes us, in some cases, it might make us give up, but in many cases, it makes us want the person even more, and we can't stop thinking about them, perhaps. And then especially if we get access to a person and we have a really good experience, but it's not maybe so easy to repeat that experience. Maybe the person has some mixed feelings, or sometimes they're more available to us than at other times. And so that getting the reward of that wonderful experience on some occasions, but other times it's more difficult, that's the kind of thing that can produce a sort of obsession, an erotic obsession for someone that we cannot easily have. And it's the dynamic interaction between our desire and things that kind of get in the way or make it complicated that lead to the highest forms of sexual excitement. And the other thing I want to say about that, because people always jump to naturally the obvious examples, like the long distance or having make-up sex after a fight, or having good sex when you've been away from your partner, you've been separated, or something like that.
So anticipation has been building.
Anticipation builds. And also I think when partners have a fight or a disagreement, they are reminded that they are two separate people. Because sometimes when couples are together for a long period of time, they can sort of blend together into like a mushy kind of unit.
Two hearts beating as one.
Yes, so that sounds good as an aspiration, but you know, as a reality, two hearts beating as one is not very erotic, really.
No.
What we need is a dynamic between two separate individual people who find each other fascinating. That's where you get the passion. But it doesn't have to be a fight. It doesn't have to be separation from each other. Sometimes the obstacles that really make the difference are anything that reminds the partners that they are two separate people. So that is not downplaying differences and disagreements. You know how some really nice, loving, caring partners won't say anything to each other that might be, a little upsetting, or maybe, I don't know if my partner wants to hear this, so I won't say it. I just won't mention that I have a different opinion than they do, because I don't want there to be something disagreeable in the air. And when people do that, when they downplay just everyday differences between them and their partner, what they do is they dampen the dynamic that could keep the erotic spark going in their relationship. So sometimes the obstacle is just the reminder that, oh, gee, my partner is not me.
Exactly. And our colleague, David Snarch, expands on this a lot.
Yes.
Very
compatible with his work, which is
differentiation.
Differentiation, where, you know, relationship building is the process of each person being more and more of their true selves in the presence of the other. which to my mind is the best definition of intimacy that I know of.
Yes, I think it's wonderful. Now, you say in your book, at the heart of lusty attraction lies the desire for sexual excitement and orgasmic release, pure and simple. It can be profound, utterly meaningless, playful, loving, or hostile. It can be all of those things.
Again.
Yes.
Deliciously nasty, etc.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But those are lusty attractions, and they can be very powerful, as most of us know.
Mm-hmm. And I come up against something else that you talk about in your book, and under the heading "The Dark Side of Love," where, because I see lots of couples, lots of marriage counseling, and one person is really wanting to control the other, and you write, you begin to feel the need to control your lover, inevitably. You have crucial emotional interest to protect because your well-being now seems to depend on the actions and feelings of someone else. In addition, you naturally want to express the enlarged sense of self he or she has stimulated. And you want your beloved to recognize and respond to your needs. And this is so true, preferably knowing what they are as if by magic. You know, it's like going on a treasure hunt without any clues. There's not very much communication. But can you speak a little bit more about the push for both surrender and control and their destructive extremes?
Well, every relationship involves some kind of power dynamic, no matter how subtle it may be, because bring two people together and they each bring a history, a set of needs, a set of fears, mm-hmm. a set of hopes and dreams to the enterprise. And that means that, like you said in that quote there from my book, that the stakes are high.
The stakes are high, yeah.
And the closer we feel, the more attached we become, the more vulnerable we become, the higher the stakes. And that means then that this person who we've hooked our wagons to, we has the power to make our lives better or to make our lives a living hell. They could make us feel loved and worthy, or they can make us feel worse than anyone else on the planet, right? And they can, in the end, reject us or leave us. And so there's a lot at stake. And so it's natural that we, in certain ways, want to control the partner or at least influence them to meet our needs in the ways that in which we would like them to be met. But our partner has their own mind, their own personality, their own way of doing things, their own set of experiences, and so they don't do everything that we might ideally wish they would do, or they don't do it the way we wish they would, or when we wish they would. And so that's when we can slip into a controlling situation where we're trying to get them to be the person that we want to be. And a little bit of this is okay and inevitable. Just it's part of the interaction of two complicated people. But when it becomes a game to try to control the other, to make them be the person that we want them to be, for one thing, we lose sight of who they actually are. And it's only a matter of time until we dampen their spirit as a person by trying to over-control them, and they will inevitably become less interesting to us in the end. If we should succeed in over-controlling our partner, what we will have is a compliant person who's no longer very interesting.
Well, I never allowed my first two husbands to do that to me, but there was a certain amount of controlling because
we try to do that. Sometimes we just ask for things. Sometimes we demand things. We threaten things. We pout if we don't get what we want. We withhold sex sometimes if we don't get what we want. And we have all sorts of rewards and punishments that we use on each other, don't we?
Yes, but, you know, the thing that I always battled is that I was always quite strong and self-sufficient and courageous. At 24 years of age, I went around the world alone for 9 months. And so that was intimidating for a lot of men at the time, my age. So I needed somebody strong.
Do you
strong.
Think they didn't know if they could keep up with you, or maybe you just were too experienced for them? Or
yeah, there were lots of things. You quote Dr. Person, who sums up the danger of the push for both surrender and control. When the pursuit of merger is unchecked, the lover becomes either a slave or a tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it also is pretty understandable.
Yes, it is.
That this kind of thing happens, but it's something we have to watch out for, because unless, you know, there's times where playing with power can be very exciting and fun and passionate, but
mm-hmm.
when we do it without consciousness and we start controlling each other,
mm-hmm.
Not for pleasure, but out of fear, especially, then we dampen each other's enthusiasm in the end,
mm-hmm.
and we grow distant.
Exactly. And so that the feeling that, you know, my partner is not really loving me for who I am, but
yeah.
wanting me to be somebody else, to more fit his or her needs and expectations.
Exactly. And isn't that, it can be such a painful experience, like when you have a romantic attachment with someone,
mm-hmm.
and they think you're fabulous and you think they're fabulous. It's a mutual admiration society.
Right.
And it's very passionate and uplifting for all concerned. And then as the relationship evolves over time, then gradually or suddenly, you're trying to change this person who originally was so perfect.
Suddenly your partner says, now I want you to roll over and bark like a chicken.
Exactly.
Like a chicken.
Yeah.
Bark like a chicken.
That's difficult.
Which is not a very easy thing to do.
There you go. Oh, there goes my idealism.
Kind of a losing proposition.
Wolf like a cat, yeah.
So it's very painful when our partner, who once thought we were terrific, starts demanding that we be different.
Wait, you're not the one-eyed bondage antelope I married.
And, of course, what is necessary to point out to a number of the couples in my practice is you can't hope to change the other. In changing the system, you really have to change yourself. And it's, you know, in behavioral psychology, of course, that's called the change-first principle.
Mm-hmm.
And to really be introspective and think how you might change. And then often when you change, there are some either subtle or not so subtle changes in the other in response, or it creates a break
mm-hmm.
in the relationship. Let's go on, Jack, to your chapter 3, the four cornerstones of eroticism. And just to give our listening audience an overview first, they are, number one, longing and anticipation. Two, violating prohibitions. Three, searching for power. We've already discussed that a little bit. And four, overcoming ambivalence. And we, let's see, we've got maybe 11 minutes left in this hour. So let's at least make a beginning, and thank goodness we have part two in 2 weeks.
Well, I think we can get into this pretty well in the time that we have, Diana.
Good.
To put them in perspective a little bit,
mm-hmm.
I think of these four cornerstones of eroticism as being, you might call them, existential obstacles. And let me tell you what I mean by that. I'm thinking about first the erotic equation, which we just spoke about, attraction plus obstacles equals excitement. I got to thinking when I was first doing this work, this research, what are the experiences of being a human being and growing up and developing that inherently involve obstacles? And in other words, they're part of the human experience, and there's obstacles involved. My hypothesis was that those challenges of living that involve overcoming obstacles would become very crucial themes in people's erotic lives.
And
so what it turns out is there. I'm not saying these are the only four by any means, but there are four that showed up a lot and were very, very powerful themes that ran through the erotic stories. And they're based on experiences that we inevitably have being human. Some people have these experiences more than others. Like, for example, who doesn't have the experience while growing up of wanting something from a parent or a sibling or someone that we rely upon that we are not getting in the way we want it or as much as we want it or when we want it? We all know about longing for something that we cannot easily get because the world just does not satisfy us perfectly, right? That's kind of how it is. No matter how loving an environment we grow up in, there's always something missing at certain times that we long for. And so you find that for many, many people, the theme of longing for what we cannot easily have becomes very erotically significant because it does involve overcoming an obstacle. And lots of people are not very excited unless they're longing for someone, or longing for someone in a way they don't quite have them, or wanting, you know, a lot of people who even are in committed relationships still long and wish that their partner would love them in some kind of a different way or would express their love in a different way that they could feel more deeply or something like that. So you find in the erotic stories people talking about how much they longed for what they inevitably or eventually get in their peak erotic experiences. It's like, I always wanted this person, or I always wanted to be to feel this way or to be treated this way. And then the sort of close cousin of that longing experience is anticipating that maybe we'll get it. And so there's a lot of anticipation in erotic life, that kind of looking for the possibilities that exist in any given moment, of maybe something that we really want and need and desire will show itself, or we'll be able to get at it or win it over. So a lot of anticipation goes on. And so someone who has a lot of longing in their erotic life, in that longing really turns them on, that can become a problem because it can be difficult then to be turned on with someone you actually have.
Yes, and you write, one of the great paradoxes of erotic life is that even though longing craves fulfillment, fulfillment dampens longing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's the paradoxical aspect.
That's the paradox.
We want this experience, this connection, or this lusty experience, but then when we get it, we can't so easily long for it. Now, we might very well long for it again and again and again, but at some point, if it becomes predictable, it gets harder and harder to long for it. And so that is a problem that many long-term couples face, is they can take each other for granted.
Absolutely. And I have found that emotional undernourishment devastates so many long-term marriages where they don't say, this is what I value and appreciate about you, taking each other for granted. A fascinating statistic just came up that the day after Mother's Day last year, Ashley Madison, the website for people who want to cheat on their marriages, they have 31,000 new women signing up the day after Mother's Day. The day after Valentine's Day is another time that these married women are signing up. They want to have an affair. Mm-hmm. They're not satisfied. They're not being appreciated, either as apparently wives or as mothers. So they want some excitement outside.
Yeah.
Of the marriage. I thought that was really interesting.
Very interesting statistic.
Kind of sad, but...
It is.
Yeah. But,
well, but it also makes a certain sense, too.
Yes.
It does.
Yes, exactly. So your cornerstone...
So that's longing, but
yeah.
And we've already talked about violating prohibitions.
Yes,
we spoke quite a bit about that earlier.
Yes, we did.
And how, you know, every society tries to control the sexuality of its children,
mm-hmm.
one way or another, and that can inhibit the children, but mm-hmm. it also can... Many of those children are going to discover that breaking those rules, whatever they may be, can be a big turn-on because it releases a charge. It's like my desire is greater than the rules that are trying to control me.
That's very well put.
It's like an intensifier to
mm-hmm.
break the rules. It's like a statement of autonomy and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
The more rules we have around to break, the more likely we are to discover that particular turn-on.
But you're 13, son, and you're a member of the Papua New Guinea tribes. Don't you want to be ritually circumcised at age 13 with an Assyrian knife? Well, Dad, I've decided to become a Catholic priest. Gee, what's the harm? I mean, everybody goes... Well, if everybody decided not to be ritually circumcised with an obsidian knife at age 13, you wouldn't either?
Jack, in the few minutes that we have, could we skip, because we've already discussed some of these other things.
Talk quite a bit about power.
Well, we did talk about power, but I'm thinking Cornerstone 4, overcoming ambivalence.
Yeah.
I guess we touched on it, but could you just...
We have touched on it because of the vulnerabilities involved
right.
in getting close to people. We all, almost all of us, long to connect on a deep level, and this goes way back to the beginning of our lives. Throughout our lifetimes, we long for this connection. We need it, really, most of us. But the thing is that it's risky, that we can get hurt, or we can get disappointed,
mm-hmm.
We can, be left. We can be really devastated by our attachments. And so most of us approach the enterprise of getting close to someone with some level of mixed feelings about it. And when you think about it, the mixed feelings that we have of I want to get close, but I don't want to take too many risks, it's like its own built-in obstacle we feel within ourselves. It's the draw to closeness combined with the fear of the potential for hurt, and that we have to overcome our fears one way or the other in order to get the thing we want, the connection or the erotic intensity. And so that's overcoming our fears basically coaxes our desires to get stronger so that what we want is more important to us than what we fear.
Oh, that's excellent, and it takes a certain amount of confidence, self-confidence, which can flow over into, ultimately, to sexual confidence, and then back again. It's almost like a positive feedback loop. But as you do have, and as you say in the beginning of your book, just as surely as passion strives for fulfillment, fulfillment longs for passion. And between the two, Eros flourishes. Like that a lot. And
well, that really maybe captures that paradoxical quality. It's a dance.
I think so. I think so. And I am just delighted, Jack, that you'll be back for part two on the 27th because there is so much more to discuss. I think some more for the erotic mind, and then to talk about your book, Anal Pleasure and Health.
Well, that would be a lot of fun all the way around. Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And Billy, glad you're back.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. Still a mammal with opposable thumbs. May I mention also, next week our guest will be Michael Castleman, the author of Sexual Solutions.
Thank you, Billy.
Happy feet, da da da, happy feet. Oh, I love it. Santa, happy birthday.